If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
94.3 WIBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Juan Castillo, and this is the Electric Drum. Now, this morning we have in the studio, it's my pleasure to have Patricia Helliger. She's the captain at the New Haven Police Department, actually the first African-American female captain here in the city. I've been meaning to get her into the studio. You know, what an inspiration her life has been. And, you know, we're going to be talking to her about her life and also some of the other things that she's doing in the community. How you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
Wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. So you were born in St. Martin. You know,
yes.
We were talking about that earlier, right? And you moved here to the United States when you were seven.
Yeah.
To Brooklyn, New York, my hometown also. So tell me about growing up in St. Martin. Tell me about what kind of life that was like.
Well, you know what? I don't really don't remember too much of it. I know I attended Dutch school, so I speak Dutch. That's a second language for me. My family speak Dutch. And, you know,
wow.
St. Martin is separated into two different nations, French and Dutch. So I attended Dutch school for a little bit.
Wow.
So I came to the United States. That was a little bit of a challenge.
So while you were there, you were learning both English and Dutch?
Yes.
Wow. That, you know, and you know, people say that it's easier for your children to learn to be multilingual than it is for adults.
Once you start, if you do it young. So now I pick up a little Spanish.
Wow.
So, you know, and Papiamento, which is kind of a dialect, you know, of Dutch and French.
Okay.
So that's spoken in Curacao. So yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your family. Tell me about your family in St. Martin.
Well, the entire island is my family. So once you get off the airport,
yes.
If you mention my father's name, Brooks, everyone know my father. My father is known as a founding member of the island. For those who ever visit St. Martin on cruises, because it's known for the cruises.
Right.
And you get to an opportunity to do the tour. Just between the French and the Dutch side is a statue erected of my dad. Is a gentleman sitting in a seat with a bus wheel, and he's called Tata, the bus driver. That's my dad.
Mm,
so
wow.
The entire family's, you know, is in St. Martin. Helligers, the Brookses, and go on, you know.
Right. So tell me about how's your family influenced you? Of course, your dad and your mom. How have they influenced your life?
Well, I really was more with a matriarch. I was actually raised by women.
Okay.
So that was very strong in my life. And my family have always taught me to be leaders. We've always been leaders. My father's a very strong individual who people know him. And if you just mention, I mean, his name is Jean Brooks, but if you say Tata, everyone knows him. So all of his children have been taught to be leaders. And I guess the family's kind of surprised, and not in a way, they're really not too surprised that I became the first black, you know, female captain.
Right. So you moved to the United States. You moved to Brooklyn. Tell me about the transition.
Oh, it was unbelievable. You know, Brooklyn, New York, back in the day when I was going to school, which, you know, was a while back, it was challenging in the sense of another language. I spoke Dutch. Dutch was the language that I was actually raised with. So actually reading and writing English was a little bit of a challenge. But even that I overcame. I was always an A student, and I was a track star.
Okay.
For those who Google me, I still hold the half a marathon for the city of New York.
Wow.
I was a track star. I know a few, Diane Dixon.
Wow.
Women like that. Diane Dixon was actually a teammate. So I've done quite a bit. Was an Olympic hopeful, got hurt, didn't do it. So
you ran in high school and college?
I didn't run in college. I went to Stony Brook, which didn't have a track team.
Okay.
But during the time I was in public school, PS 182,
yeah.
And then I went on to Thomas Jefferson. I was running track,
right.
But for a private club,
right.
Outside of school.
And we were just talking earlier about, you know, I went to boys' high school in New York, and Thomas Jefferson was one of our foes in the city, you know, friendly foes, you
yes.
know, you know, in all the sports. Tell me about high school. Of course, track, very important in your life, right?
You know what? Getting into sports, it kept me away from a lot of things that happened around me, because I grew up in a time in New York City, where it's very challenging with the drugs. I was in an assembly where some of my classmates were actually smoking marijuana, passing it around. I was in a school, Thomas Jefferson. Not only was it challenging, it was actually a very difficult school to get what you need because it was right in what we call the ghetto area in East New York.
Yes.
And what would happen is that I would have people, you know, fellow students smoking and doing that. But it's funny enough that when I was growing up in high school, they would do that, smoke and pass it around, and it would never pass it to me. And they would always say, nope, we're not going to give it to Pat. We're going to, they would pass it over. And it was just really kind of strange that I was very quiet, but they sort of knew that I wasn't the kind of person that was with that.
Right.
And then as I became a flight attendant and I was actually on a train in New York City one day, one of my classmates saw me. She goes, I always knew that you would be something different. So that's how it is. And that all came from my mom. Mm.
Okay.
You know, my mother and my brother, I have a brother who's like 6'5". And my mom is actually pretty tall, too. She's about 5'11".
Okay.
So I'm the short one in the family. But what happened is we were running gangs. We had some gangs, and we knew friends that were gang members.
Yes.
And my mom always told my brother and I, you're never going to get into that gang situation. She was a Caribbean woman, too.
Yes.
And they rule very strong, if you know what I'm talking
Absolutely,
about.
Absolutely, I do know.
They did not play that, and it was all about education. And my mom would always tell my brother, if you ever join a gang, I don't care how big you are, I'll just knock you right down. And then she meant that.
Yes.
She was tall like he was,
yes.
So she kept him straight, and she kept us straight. And sure enough, all the gang members knew also we were not the kind of kids. They knew where we came from. Mm. They knew our family, and they understood what we were about.
Yes. This is Juan Castillo, and I have Patricia Helliger here. She's the captain with the New Haven Police Department, first African-American female captain. We're talking about her life, how she grew up in St. Martin and came here when she was 7. I moved to Brooklyn, New York. Went to Thomas Jefferson High School there, became a track star. And we're talking about her life and her family. You know, let me ask you this. When you were in high school and you were running track and you were thinking about, like, what is it that I want to do? Was there anything that in your mind at that time that, like, you know, long term, or is that something that kind of came later?
It came later because actually when I went to, after high school, I went to Stony Brook University. I was actually pre-med.
Okay.
I was studying, you know, for medicine. And as I went on and then realized that, you know, it's still a challenge for a lot of folks, math. You have to know the math.
Yes.
You know, and that was a little challenging for me. So it got to the point, too, where I was actually kind of caring for my mom. She became ill.
Mm.
So I said, you know, I went to my guidance counselor. I said, how many credits do I have right now to leave college? Because I need to do some other things. And she said, you have enough of liberal arts and psychology. So I became a psychology minor and a liberal arts degree.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you graduate out of college and then you become a flight attendant. How did that happen?
Well, I was out of work. Flight attendant, the Pan American was asking people if they want to do it. I spoke a second language because, you know, you have to be fluent in a second language.
Okay.
In order to fly with Pan Am back in the day. So I went to the interviews and everything went well. So I started working with Pan American Airlines and became a flight attendant. I went to every continent except Australia.
Wow.
Yeah.
So tell me, what was that like? I mean, what was that experience like?
It was just, I mean, getting out of college, trying to find something to do, and actually want to get a direction in your life. That was the best thing. It opened doors. It you know, culturally, you know, I was able to meet people of different culture, although my culture is very wide anyway.
Yes.
I was able to meet people from different countries. I was able to spend time in different countries. So that was very interesting.
So from flight attendant, What was your next endeavor?
Well, Pan American went out of business, for those who remember, because
yeah,
some folks are too young to remember Pan American.
I remember.
Right. So it was always a premier airline, and then they, all of a sudden they went belly up and they went out of business. And I actually found out I was out of a job when I was in South America. I was actually in Rio.
Mm.
And the captain said, I want all the flight attendants, you guys get dressed and let's get on the airplane right away. And we're like, we've got another day to be here. But it turned out that we went Chapter 11. And if we didn't get out of Rio, the government could actually confiscate the airplane.
Wow.
So we actually came back to the United States with an airplane. And then I found out that I was out of a job sitting on, you know, my couch in the house. They said that, you know, Pan American is out of business. So that's really where I stopped my whole career. So I said, well, what do I do next? The next thing I decided to do was to write insurance for Bridgeport police officers.
Oh, okay.
So that's where I really kind of got into the law enforcement thing. So I would write insurance for them, and the guys would say, you know, you got a really good personality to become a cop. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Right, you know how that
is, right, Juan?
Exactly.
It's like the only time you see a cop is something bad, right? They don't come into the community just to talk.
True.
And they usually don't have a really good relationship with people, right?
Right.
So I was like, I don't think I want to do that. And one of them convinced me to say, listen, New Haven is hiring. And then I said, what's going on in New Haven? He said, well, they were doing some community policing.
Yes.
And they said, there's a chief up there named Chief Nicholas Pastore, and he's creating a huge program. So I read up a little bit on Pastore, and I like what they're talking about. They were talking about actually being in a community, being responsible for the community.
Yes.
Getting beepers back in those days. People can beep you. You get a card. You can actually belong to a community and police them.
Yes, yes. So you applied and went through the academy.
I did. I applied. And then when I was in the academy, Delta Airlines wanted me to become a flight attendant, you know, call them back, you know, because they actually took over Pan Am. And I was kind of debating in between, should I go back and fly? And I was like, well, you know what? I want to try something different.
Yeah.
And once I was in the academy and I did that hard work because it was hard, you know, I came on in 95 where there was a huge snowstorm and I was commuting from Bridgeport. So it was really rough and I did a lot of hard work to become a cop. So I said, you know, I'm going to stick with this.
So now at that time, there weren't a lot of females in the force, right?
Not too many, but there was a couple of them that became mentors that were actually there to say, you know, welcome aboard. One is Hilda Kilpatrick. Everybody knows her.
Oh, absolutely. I interviewed her here.
Yes. Yeah. Hilda Kilpatrick. And then there's Patricia Adger, of course.
Yes.
And then there was Palmyra. And there's a few, you know, who really kind of took me under the wings and told me a little bit of what was going on. I was like, oh, wow, there's actually women here. So.
Right. So, I mean, combination of being a female and being African American, well, you know, not African-American because you live here, but of course also you know, you're from St. Martin, so and Brooklyn.
Yes.
You know, how difficult was it, you know, in terms of being able to assimilate into you know, an organization that's militaristic in nature? You came in during a time when Chief Pastore was really trying to have a different perspective, have people in the community have a different perspective about police officers. Tell me about that experience.
Well, you know, it helped that I came in a lot more mature. I was actually the most mature person in my class because I had life experience with me. And I think that's what Chief Pastore was looking for. So I had life experience. I traveled all over the world. I've met kings, presidents, you know, so I was not intimidated by even men. So it was really no big deal for me. So when I came in with a kind of confidence that I know I want to do this. And I've always been a very confident person.
Yes.
You know, so I was not at all intimidated. When I was in a flight as a flight attendant, I was a purser, what they call a purser, meaning I was in charge of an entire crew.
Okay.
When I worked as a flight attendant. So having that supervisory thing and management things with me, I came in with that.
Right.
So that was really not a problem. And I think, you know, funny enough, I think a lot of people was expecting me to come in. A lot of people talking about the men in the job.
Yeah, right.
Kind of like intimidated. I've never been intimidated by it.
Wow, great.
And I grew up around men, you know. I mean, my father and very strong men.
Right.
So that was never a problem.
Yeah. So tell me about the first day on the job. Do you remember it?
With training or actually out on the street, I was actually excited. I was really excited. I think it was actually a very cold time for us because we actually got sworn in February 19th, 1996. I remember that. So we were out there, and I remember me and my partner, it was very cold. And I said, wow, what this is all about, you know? And then we had to walk, and I was like, this could be interesting, but we have to do some things to get warm.
Right.
You know, so I was very excited. I had no complaints. And I was like, wow, I should have probably tried this a lot sooner.
Right, you know? Right. Mm-hmm. Juan Castillo with you. I'm speaking with Patricia Helliger. She's the captain with the New Haven Police Department. And we're talking about her life here, you know, working for the department. And we've been talking about her life, period. And we're now at the stage where, you know, she has now joined the New Haven Police Department and working under Chief Pastore into our new community policing program that, of course, you know, has gained recognition throughout the country as a premier program. Tell me about that program. Tell me how it helps with having folks look at the police differently.
Well, first of all, I think the fact that Chief Pastor brought women on, what a different touch.
Yes.
You know, because most people expect police officers to be male, real rugged, real hard. So that was a nice touch. And I think that bringing women into the policing was a really smart idea. So my approach, you know, to the community was a little different than the male police officers that most of the community was used to. And I remember going out there since I said, well, this is community. This is about have me owning an area. I used to walk on Winchester Avenue. Right. You know how that is, right?
Yeah,
down
absolutely.
The tourist club, the rest of the whole strip. And actually, when I got there, I owned that whole area.
It's no different than Liberty Avenue and
yes, Pitkin. Exactly. So it was there was no
Full
problem
Street.
For me. Exactly. So I came out there and I was like, well, I kind of like this. And I would walk over to people and I'd say hello. And folks were kind of surprised, you know, that I spoke to them. And I'm like, well, I'm kind of liking this because I felt at home. You know, I felt, you know, I felt really comfortable. I was never really, you know, frightened or nervous, you know, and I had really good mentors. I had some really good people to show me, you know, things that are going on. You know, Reggie Sutton was one of my partners, and people remember Reggie Sutton, and he just took me under his wing. So it's important, too, in policing, when you come out as a rookie, that you have that veteran to be able to show you certain things. So I was actually surrounded with some really good and talented officers that helped me out through the whole thing.
Yeah, so, you know, so you are part of being a beat cop, you know, working in the community. When did you start thinking about, you know, moving up, you know, as in a supervisory role?
Well, you know, the test came out.
Okay.
They say that, you know, the sergeant test is coming up. Are you going to take it? I said, of course I am. You know, why wouldn't I take it? So when in less than 4 years into my stay as a rookie, they offered the test. So in 4 years, I'm one of the few people who actually got promoted in the fourth year as a sergeant.
Wow.
So I was a sergeant in 4 years on the job. And then we had to wait for different things to happen. And then I became a lieutenant. And I still didn't plan it to say, you know, listen, I'm going to do this. But as I continue in the police department, it just became easy for me to do that.
Right.
You know, so.
I got to say something to you. I have a friend, you know, who is, you know, very much into the news and, you know, a critical thinker, you know. And we were talking about initiatives to try to help police officers be more sensitive to African Americans as a whole, but to the community, period. And how can people in positions of in supervisory positions within a police department affect how officers do their jobs on a daily basis? So what he was saying, what you came up, you know, he said, you know, Juan, you just had a new captain in New Haven. She's African-American, right? He's very jaded when it comes down to these kinds of things. So he was saying, well, you know, we've got a black president. We also got at the time it was Eric Holder, you know, and then the other young lady, Loretta, I think her name is, she's taken over.
Correct.
And he was complaining about how in their positions, you know, they weren't able to really bring officers to, you know, to justice based on some of the shootings and so forth and so on. Right. So he said to me, well, do you think anything is going to change in New Haven because this woman was hired? Right. So I said to him, I said, well, you got to understand something, right? It's like if she is committed to having a certain, bringing a certain kind of environment and attitude to the job, her officers are going to react that way because they're being supervised that way.
Correct.
I said, now, you know, I don't know her personally, but I've heard some great things about her, and I would expect that. I mean, rather, I got to wait and see, right? You know, and see if, in fact, on the whole watch, things change, right? This is the conversation we had.
Wow.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
So I want to ask you, right? You know, what's your supervision, what's your supervisory style and philosophy when it comes down to supervising your officers?
Well, I think you lead by example.
Yes.
I think you got to be out there. You got to know the officers. You got to be able to talk to them and find out where they're going in their direction. And as making a change, you can tell your friend, I already made a change. I'm in part, I created, and he can Google this, I created the warrant initiative program, Safe Surrender.
Okay.
That allow our folks who have these warrants, little warrants, misdemeanor, felonies. You know, nowadays you can't go anywhere, could do a background check on you.
Yes.
So I was able to create it. I created that program that last year over 500 people walk into the police department and turn themselves in.
Wow.
And it's still going. I mean, people come every day and do it because now we set up an attitude within the New Haven Police Department where people feel comfortable and they come in and they know that they're going to be treated right. You know, it's a trust thing that was created. I started that program in 2013. So it's kind of something that's continuing now, and it's this building.
Right.
So last year, over 500 people walk into the police department. I don't think you could think of any police department where people did that, and I did that. So tell him that the change is, you know, I can make change. I do have a boss, and I have a chief who actually he's the boss, and he makes the change, and he says, well, this is what we're going to do. But I've created change because I asked, and I said, let's try this. I also tried in Lincoln Bassett School. Some kids were having some issues. And, you know, Lincoln Bassett at one point was a real challenging school, was a failing school.
Yes.
But before they even did that research on Bassett, I created a building Horizon to Cultural Diversity. I had officers from different cultures, from Puerto Rico, from Guatemala. We have officers from Russia that actually work in the police department, would go to the school every once a month and actually talk about their culture.
Right.
So I had created that program.
Right. That's wonderful. You mentioned earlier about, you know, fear, right? You know, and one of the things that I surmise that sometimes a lot of these bad shootings and a lot of situations that happen in our community between officers and folks in our community comes from a perception that all of us are dangerous, right?
Yes.
How do you deal with that?
Well, it's hard for me to see that because I'm seeing my people. I'm part of the community.
Mm.
When I take off this uniform, I walk down the street, I am you.
Yes.
You know, and that's why I say my beloved community.
Yes.
Because I am a reflection of the people I police.
Mm.
And I have to treat people the way I want to be treated, no matter when.
Yes.
So I think that when we do have a challenge in the police department, when we get people or officers from outside of the community, I think that we need to spend a little more time culturally getting these folks to actually know the community and being part of the community. And you're right. You know, some folks have never been around African-American or minorities, and they become police officers. They need to be a stronger program with that because we're just like anyone else.
Right. Well, one of the things that I said to my friend was that, you know, I've been in that situation, you know, working in law enforcement myself. And as a supervisor, you know, I was fair to everyone, but I also made it clear that I wasn't going to tolerate some certain behavior. But in addition to that, whenever I recognized that someone had that fear, I tried to make the person understand that, look, you know, that fear is natural. I mean, you know, you're working in the field and, you know, and you don't know who's who, right? So that's natural, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you have to temper that with the attitude that, you know, everyone is not your enemy in the community.
That's
you know
correct.
What I mean?
Yes.
You know, so, but yeah, that's wonderful. So now you not only have you been working with that, but tell me this other program that we talked about on the phone that you're also trying to do.
What I do, the program you're probably referring to is a Kenyan nonviolence training.
That's the one.
Yes.
Right, okay.
It's actually what it is actually the Connecticut Center for Nonviolence, and Victoria Kreskow is actually the director. Pastor Lewis, a lot of people know him in the community. Myself and two other officers have been trained. And what we're called is the Kenyan nonviolent training.
Okay.
And what we've been doing is we trained some Yale University police officers just recently. And it's actually getting the officers to understand some of the Kenyan concept and principles. And, you know, he has some steps, too, doing the civil rights that tell you how to resolution, conflict resolution.
Yes.
So it's actually training officers on basic steps.
Mm.
So we are instructors. There are three of us, Jacqueline Hoyt, she's sergeant, and then Lieutenant Sam Brown. So we are the three initial people who started that to be actual trainers. And it's just fantastic because what we're doing now, we're going around the different places and we're training officers and we're training community. We're training high school children how to actually do for resolution and steps. And there's a Kenyan principle to live by.
Yes.
And there's some principles you have to live by it. And the Kenyan, to be honest with you, when I started the Kenyan training, it was something I've been doing all my life. Mm. It's a concept. I knew Dr. King. I was young when Dr. King actually died, but I was a child of the 60s.
Yes.
So when they taught us in school about Dr. King, there's now so much that's missing.
Yes.
So what we need to also know, and I try to tell children when I talk to them, I was just recently speaking to kids in Sacred Heart, the Upward Bound. Back in my days, it was called Model Cities.
Yes.
So I was talking to some kids at Upward Bound, and I said, do you know children was incarcerated in the South, and they made the change?
Right.
So children can make a change in our community when things are not right. You have a voice.
And most change in most countries comes from the youth.
There you go.
You know.
So, and then to just learn so much about Dr. King, you know.
You mentioned conflict resolution, which, you know, I mean, it affects all in everyone's life, right? You know, within a family, there could be a conflict, and you got to try to resolve it. A police officer is in the community; he's called to a call, and two people are arguing and getting ready to fight.
Correct.
Got to deal with it, right?
We don't even call conflict; we call it reconciliation.
Right.
Because what it is we want both parties to feel that they have won something.
Yes.
You know. So we teach to talk about conflict, aggression. We talk about different type of aggression. Mm. It's a whole training. It's 80 hours of training, and then Dr. Lafayette, who was one of Dr. King's friends. And if you Google Dr. Lafayette, he was right next to Dr. King.
I'm familiar with it.
He was an instructor.
Yes.
He's part of the Connecticut Center for Nonviolence. So to be there with someone who actually knew Dr. King and train with him. So it's a great, great program. And we really trying to do as much as we can to get it out there to Kenyan nonviolence training.
Yeah, and for young people, I mean, one of the things that's interesting because, growing up, and also watching today's youth, it's interesting, especially among African Americans, we got this thing about, you disrespected me, right? And that disrespect kind of whole thing, a lot of times leads to someone getting shot and getting killed, just because, you got to respect me, right? And sometimes it's false bravado in the middle of all of that.
Correct.
But that's important for them too, and that's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you for coming. It's been a pleasure. I've been meaning to get you here. Congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
I could seriously tell my friend now that she is making a difference.
Yes, tell him that. Thank you so much for having me today. And it's a pleasure. And I'm just like said to my community out there, just remember that, the law enforcement officers, we need help too. We're part of the community and we are guardians. We're guardians of community.
Yes.
We're actually supposed to be part of the community. And that's why I embrace community-based policing.
Right. Last question. I don't know if you can answer this. What's the best advice you ever gotten from who?
That came from my mom. Very young. She told me, she said, no matter what, my mom wasn't very well educated, but she always said to me, and this is probably a Caribbean thing. It's not probably unusual, but it said, once you get that education and you put it in your head, nobody can take it away from you.
Yes.
No matter how hard they try. Because once you put something in your brain, nobody can take it from you.
They can take
everything else. So that's how I lived since I was younger. And I got educated and I learn and keep learning. And that's where I am here now.
Today. Well, that's fantastic. Well, Captain, thank you so much for coming. And maybe the next time I interview you, you'll be chief.
Oh, okay. We'll see.
Hey, I can wish, right?
Thank you. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Compliment.
Thank you so much for coming.
All right. You're welcome.
Juan Castillo with you. I know you've been inspired. I have. This is the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. We'll see you next week.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.